From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Detroit teachers are in day two of their sick out. We talk with the senator who's shepherding that DPS aid package through the legislature.
Some people want to just blow everything up, and it's like, we can't do that. We have 47,000 kids that need a great education.
Is history's curtain closing on villages?
We have homeowners associations in some other parts of the state that have more residents than these villages.
The mood in Flint on the eve of the president's visit.
We've seen many failed strategies, and some would say even that some are more concerned about a cover-up versus a cleanup.
And the young tree hunter who discovered Michigan's biggest sycamore.
Our entire family tried to hug the tree, and we still needed about two more people.
Those stories and more. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President Obama's visit tomorrow puts the national spotlight right back on Flint and its water crisis. Coming up, State Representative Sheldon Neely, Democrat and lifelong Flint resident, will be here to talk about whether the state has really done all it can to help Flint. But first, there's an historic question being put before voters in today's election in the village of Richland, whether or not to dissolve the village. If the answer is yes, it will be the first time in Michigan history that a village has disincorporated. Eric Lufer is with us now. Eric's the president of the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. Eric, we're talking about a one-square-mile village northeast of Kalamazoo. It's been around since 1871. Why is there a proposal on today's ballot to dissolve it?
Richland residents, like a lot of village residents, are looking at how their system of government fits in with the sort of the big picture and whether in today's day and age a village structure is necessary, or can't they get the services they need from the township and the county and be just as well served.
So it sounds like we'd like to maybe reduce taxes and not be paying more than we need to?
That certainly is a factor playing into bringing this to a vote. We also know that a lot of these very small units of government, less than 1,000 people, the politics gets rancorous and everybody knows everybody, and you know, so that plays into it as well, I'm sure.
So what are the arguments for those who want to preserve the village as is, that is, as it's been since 1871?
Well, the status quo is kind of the idea that you have a area where people have congregated over the years, put houses and small businesses, and they need a higher level of services than the township typically has been able to provide, and it's worth a few extra dollars in taxation. It's worth creating a system of government that is going to serve their needs collectively, and so they're willing to have that added layer of government, have some level of inefficiency, but to have it there to serve their needs. When we were doing this in Onekama, looking at a question of dissolution of a small village in Manistee County, there was a process and a coordination with the township to decide which of those village services are important enough to the residents that they really would like the township to pick that up and keep it going. In that case, the tax base was sufficient that it wasn't going to cost the township residents any more money.
And I guess it raises the question, is it time to bid farewell to this historic idea of village? Is it too quaint? Is it not something that belongs in 2016?
I think you're onto something there. We have a system of government that was set up to sort of be a stepping stone. Township to a village to a city as the area got bigger and more dense and demanded greater levels of services. We've long since abandoned that sort of stepping stone approach. And we have cities that look like villages. We have townships that look like cities. Most of our townships are able to provide any level of services that any city or village is able to do. And so we have kind of built in a level of inefficiency, a level of duplication by putting villages on top of the township to have two levels of government serving those people. And certainly if we're looking for efficiencies, if we're looking to cut cost of local government, taking a hard look at villages is a good place to start.
At the same time, kind of, you know, looking at the teeter-totter or the balances back and forth, you could be losing some deep roots and some deep sense of identity that has been around for many decades.
Well, that's true to some extent, but we also know that we have villages in the state that are not incorporated. There's a sense of community around the place within the township where there is some greater concentration of people. They still have their parades and they still have a concentration of downtown sort of businesses, but they haven't organized in a way to pay taxes on top of the township taxes. They're not electing additional officials to be paid a government salary. We have homeowners associations in some other parts of the state that have more residents than these villages, and we haven't created additional government to serve those homeowners associations. The question is, why do we need those? What we have now is organized villages.
And interesting, as you mentioned, Eric, you worked on that effort in Manistee County to perhaps dissolve Onekama. That proposal didn't pass. It remains to be seen whether today's proposal in the village of Richland gets the two-thirds vote it needs. Do you think, though, this is only a matter of time before one of these proposals sticks and actually, you know, you see the first dissolution of a village in Michigan history?
You know, we're seeing it more and more. We had it up north. Last year, we looked at Saugatuck and Douglas, two cities considering getting together. Sooner or later, it's going to happen. And I think it's going to take some state leadership to get in and help these people or understand how their small unit of government fits into the overall structure and why it's significant. To talk to the village residents in Richland or any other small village, they might not really see the big picture of how this all fits together. They're just worried about their little corner of the world. And so that's going to take some leadership at the state level to help make that happen, I think.
Eric Lufer is the president of the Citizens Research Council of Michigan, talking about the vote in today's election in the village of Richland, whether or not to dissolve that village. Eric, thanks so much for talking with us on Stateside. Always great to have you on.
Thank you once again for having me.
Its title, Fart, a documentary. And yep, it's everything that title suggests.
Fart, 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 it's the fart movie.
When she farts, it's always funny, even if it smells. When I fart, it's only sometimes funny, depending on a lot of factors.
I thought, at last, somebody's making a film about farting. It's been a long time coming.
Three, two, one.
All right, Fart, a documentary, was made by Emmy-winning former TV news reporter and producer Troy Hale, who's now a professor of telecommunication information studies and media at Michigan State University and director-owner of Tricky Hale Films. Troy, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, the first question, I'm sure you get it a lot, why?
Oh, I'm getting that question a lot. One of the things was, you know, I think some friends and family got together and we just started talking about it, of course, like you do with friends and family. And we were just laughing for about an hour about this. So I kind of thought about that and said, you know, that might make a good film. And of course, that's, you know, that film's been made before, right? It can't be an original idea. And I looked it up and all I could find was some 1990 French television show that had been made about it. So I said, well, you know, this is kind of a unique topic, and I think maybe it would make a good movie.
So what was the goal? What did you want to explore when it came to farting?
Well, for me, I do a lot of series documentaries. You know, with MSU, we've done a lot of really cool films, and I wanted to do something for myself that was a little bit more entertaining, something that was humorous. So I kind of picked the topic, and when I did research on the subject, there's a whole lot of information about farting that you never even knew about. So my research ended up being about 95 pages of a Word document.
My word. That's a lot. I think we're all a little surprised to know there's that much out there about farting.
Surprisingly, yeah. Well, you know, you go onto the internet, there's quite a bit of stuff.
And you have in your film the world's only performing flatulist, Mr. Methane from England. He's been on many a shock radio morning show. I know that. Who else do you have in your movie?
We have Jim Dawson. He's an author. He wrote a trilogy of fart books. You know, one fart book wasn't enough, so there was a trilogy of them. We have a doctor in there. We have a humor expert. We have my parents are in there, of course. You know, farting is always, you know, passed down from generation to generation, that kind of humor. So I think most families can kind of relate to that one way or another.
And there is a kind of a great comment in your film that I saw, that farting is the first thing we laugh at, and then for some reason most of us always laugh at farting, although to others it is so offensive. So there's not really a middle ground, is there?
No, but I think to the people that find it offensive, I think deep down inside they still think it's funny. You know, they'll probably seem like they're disgusted about it, leave the room, and just crack up when they get to the kitchen or something. You
Why
know?
Is it so funny to us, do you think? What'd you hear?
Well, it's one of those things we repress. It's one of those things that is not polite in today's society to do it, you know, in public. But when it happens in public, it's so funny because we're so happy it didn't happen to us, you know.
True.
So I think that's part of it.
Is there a difference, did you find out, in the way people react to farting depending on where in the world you live?
You know, the funny thing is what I've found so far is that it seems to be a humorous topic everywhere.
Hmm.
And that's really interesting to me because, you know, humor is different in different cultures and different countries. And for some reason, farting is just, it's a funny thing everywhere in the world. And that was really interesting.
Well, one of the things I'm sure that you learned as you kind of dug in and as you were making your documentary on farting is that there's different expectations for men and women. Why is it we expect men to fart and women are supposed to discreetly pass gas?
You know, that is kind of a funny thing. I still don't really know why that is. One of the things that came up in the film was, you know, it's not ladylike to pass gas. And men, it's that kind of locker room humor type thing. But, you know, some of the stats that come out is pretty funny about that. The doctor said that men tend to pass gas more often, but women's gas seems to be more odorous.
Oh, lovely. What has been the response so far to Farta documentary?
Everybody's been pretty positive about it. There's a couple comments here and there that are like, I'm not going to watch that. Well, that's fine. It's not for everybody. But there's nothing really negative about it, which I'm really happy about. It is one of those weird kind of topics. But so far, it's been a great reception for it.
Oh, I know. We've all been talking about it in the stateside room. Like, we're talking about the fart movie this week. How can people check it out?
Well, it's on Amazon. Amazon has the DVDs. You can also see it on Vimeo. It's on iTunes, Vudu. So there's a number of online platforms right now, and we're hoping to get it on television in the next year, and we're actually going to be trying to sell it internationally as well.
The title is Fart, a Documentary, brought to us by Troy Hale, Michigan State University Professor of Telecommunication, Information Studies, and Media, and the owner of Tricky Hale Films. Again, that film, Fart, a Documentary. Thanks for taking us where we never thought we were going to go on stateside, Troy.
No problem. Thanks for talking about it.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Every year since 1993, the group Relief Michigan encourages us to get out of the woods and search for the biggest tree we can find. They call it the Michigan Big Tree Hunt. This year, a 13-year-old girl found the biggest tree in Lenawee County and perhaps even the entire state of Michigan. The president of Relief Michigan, and that's R-E-L-E-A-F, is with us now. Bill Lawrence, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And the discoverer of this huge tree is Kendall Covey, and she is a seventh grader at Sand Creek Schools in Lenawee County. Kendall Covey, hello.
Hi.
How did you find out about this contest, Kendall?
My neighbor, Dawn Thomas, she is very nature-y, and she knew about this, and my other neighbor let me use this tree on her property and found out that it was one of the biggest.
And Bill, this has been going on now for a while, right? Tell us how it works.
Well, it's something we promote at the beginning of the two-year period. It's a two-year run for each nominating event. And anybody in the state of Michigan can apply or send in a nomination. Then we have tree care professionals that act as qualifiers that will go out and confirm the measurements and the species identification.
Almost like the judges.
Yeah, judges, essentially, throughout the state. And then the only measurement we ask the nominator to take is the tree circumference, or the trunk circumference. That's the distance around the trunk, chest high.
And tell me about Kendall's tree. What kind of measurements does this behemoth have?
That had a circumference of 315 inches. That's a diameter of over 100 inches.
Kendall, I see this great picture that that was in the Daily Telegram, and there you were with your sister trying to hug it, and I'm telling you, this is something else.
Yeah, our entire family tried to hug the tree, and we still needed about two more people.
Oh, my goodness.
We aren't exactly sure how old it is. I didn't see it until I was about 10, and when I first heard about it, I thought that they were saying that it was a really tall tree. And as soon as I went out and saw it, I figured out that they meant it was big around, and it was just really cool.
Where is it located? I mean, it certainly has been allowed to rest in peace for a long, long time to get this big.
It is in like the middle of a cornfield. You can't see it on the road or where we live.
So it's in a nice, safe location.
Yeah. There's like a big bunch of other bushes and plants surrounding it, and I think that's how it got to that size.
Bill Lawrence, what did the tree experts find as far as height, and also how old is this sycamore?
It's really difficult to estimate age unless you actually drill into the tree, which we don't want to do. The estimate can be made up to a range based on the diameter, and I would say it's well in excess of 100 years old, and it very well could be 200 years old. Mm. Each ring is a growth year of growth, so it depends how fast it grows, how many rings are going to be within a certain diameter. But this is a monster. It's not a fast-growing tree either. That's why I also estimate that it has to be at least 100 and could be 200. It's a very hard wood. In fact, the wood is often used for things like kitchen utensils and rolling pins because it does not have a lot of pore space to collect bacteria. And it has been used for bowling pins.
Sturdy stuff. And is it very tall?
This particular tree, I don't know what the height is, because as I say, we only collect the diameter and confirm that. But I would guess this tree would be at least 100 feet tall.
This is a beauty.
It is. It's absolutely a monster.
So what happens with, for example, Kendall finds this tree in Lenawee County, you had other people around the state looking. What happens with all that information?
Well, we categorize the species and the sizes, and then the largest of the species will get awarded prizes. Our different prizes include the largest tree entered by a nominator 16 years and older, and also the largest white pine, because that's our state tree, and then the largest tree entered by a nominator 15 years and younger.
And hello, Kendall.
Yes. And she happened to be the winner.
Now, is Kendall's find in Lenawee County, is this the biggest one of anybody who was out looking in this cycle?
Yes. That was the largest tree that was nominated over the last two-year period of 14 and 15.
What's the importance of having this database? Because I'm sure you're collecting the locations and the information and keeping track of that. What's
Well, it's kind of two-prong. One is just to help the public understand the value of trees and, you know, be able to identify trees. We try to assist with that. And the other is really to record these locations of these monsters that we might be able to propagate at some time in the future, a similar great genetic tree.
So clearly, this is great genetic stock.
Yes,
and
it is.
And we know nothing lives forever.
Nothing lives forever.
Is this tracked nationally as well, then? Do you send this information on to a national listing?
We send it on to the state first. Mm-hmm. It can become a state record also, and the Michigan Botanical Club monitors that program, and then they send it on to the national. The American Forest runs that.
So the possibility exists that what Kendall found in this secluded area in Lenawee County could go all the way up to the national level.
Absolutely.
Kendall, pretty cool.
Yeah.
Are you kind of interested in this for maybe as a possible field, Kendall? Are you interested in, say, botany or forestry, or you just kind of love being outside?
I have a lot of animals, and I really enjoy being outside.
Well, this might be something you could write your college essay on. We will have to see, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we would encourage you to consider forestry or arboriculture. I'm a forester, and I've been in the industry for 42 years now.
It's got to make you happy to see
absolutely
someone who's 13 out there finding and turning in what could be the biggest tree in the state.
Absolutely.
That's great. Well, Kendall, congratulations. And we'll get this picture posted so everybody can see how big this sycamore is. And good job, Kendall.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kendall.
Kendall Covey is a seventh grader at Sand Creek Schools in Lenawee County. And also with us has been Bill Lawrence, who's the president of Relief Michigan, as we celebrate the biggest tree in Lenawee County and maybe even in the entire state, this big monster sycamore that Kendall found. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All across Michigan, high school seniors are donning their caps and gowns, getting ready to graduate. For many, the next big adventure is going away to college. So this is the time when students are making their final college choices. Allison Leota hopes that her latest book will prompt students and parents to be informed, to be aware, do some extra research, in particular, to check into reported incidents of sexual assault on campus. Allison is a crime and suspense writer, and her latest book is The Last Good Girl, and this is the day it is being released. The Last Good Girl is set at a prestigious Michigan university called Tower University. Freshman Emily Shapiro disappears after leaving a college bar, and the intense investigation reveals she'd accused a senior named Dylan Goldsmith of raping her. Allison Leota, welcome to Stateside. So good to have you here on the day the book's being released.
Thank you, Cynthia. Thank you so much for having me. It's a thrill.
I like to just pick up a book, and this is exactly what I did, fall right into it without doing any release of advanced publicity materials that get sent along. I just read the book.
Right.
I'm reading along, and your central character is a federal prosecutor named Anna Curtis, and I'm thinking, gee, this author really seems to know the ins and outs of the law and of college life. And then I discover you went to Michigan State, you went to Harvard Law, and then you were a federal prosecutor dealing with sex crimes.
Yes, I did what they say you should do, which is write what you know. So I have a federal sex crimes prosecutor protagonist doing exactly what I did when I was in Washington, D.C.
And how much of what we'll read in The Last Good Girl is based on actual things that happened?
Well, I mean, none of it technically, because right. I don't want to be sued.
Sure, but inspired by.
Sure, inspired by all of my cases around the country and by cases that I handled. There's so much going on. Unfortunately, there's too much inspiration out there right now in terms of sex assaults on college campuses. And I tried to take the most interesting and authentic bits and pieces, mm-hmm. details from all these cases and weave it into something that would be a fascinating story for someone to read in a novel.
Fascinating story and also lessons to be learned.
Absolutely. That's my favorite type of learning. I've always been a big bookworm, and I love to learn while I'm not even realizing I'm learning, while I'm just caught up in a story. And so that's the type of story I try to write.
So tell us about Emily, and especially why it was an important choice for you to make her a college freshman.
I wanted to highlight the Red Zone Week. You know, right now it's May. All those freshmen who came in last year are a little bit older and a little bit wiser. But come September, there will be a new batch of freshmen at all these college universities, and they're on their own for the first time. They're 18. They may have never had experience not having a curfew or having unfettered access to alcohol. And because they're so new and inexperienced, that is a huge time for predators to prey on them. And they call it that time the red zone because so many sexual assaults happen in that first week of college. So that's why I wanted to put Emily there, to show that through her eyes.
And Dylan, the golden boy, is a member of a prestigious fraternity. And that fraternity membership is as important as Emily's being a freshman, isn't it? Because of some statistics that you've presented that are mind-boggling about members of fraternities.
Absolutely. You know, as a sex crimes prosecutor, one thing I saw over and over was that young men in groups tend to make decisions that are quite a bit worse than young men acting by themselves. And whether we're talking street gangs or football teams or fraternities or Congress. Mm-hmm. And in fraternities in particular, the numbers are staggering. That it is estimated that boys who join fraternities are 300% more likely to rape than boys who don't.
And as we learned from your book, Dylan's fraternity, Beta Psi, air quotes, is known on campus as the rape factory. The tagline for this book really says it all. It was his word against hers until she disappeared. In your experience as a federal prosecutor, Allison, is that the way it generally is when someone presents a complaint, a sexual assault complaint?
Initially, it is his word against her word, and there is definitely a challenge when it comes to that. But I think that the best prosecutions, the best investigations, go further than just listening to what he said and she said. There's almost always corroboration in one form or another, whether it's witnesses, a bar tab, text messages, social media posts. There, you can dig deeper, can and should dig deeper. And that's what we try to do in these sex crime prosecutions, find that corroboration.
And that growing awareness of this problem of perhaps people not being believed if they try to present a case, which plays into the image of the university. And you very skillfully show the thinking behind that. But is that changing now that the kind of the white light of attention is focused on this?
I think it is changing. It has to be. We're talking about it so much. And just the act of talking about it is changing things. This is a crime that has thrived in shadows, in secrecy, in silence. So the fact that people are talking about it, it's giving a language, a vocabulary to what happened. You know what stood out to me, slightly different topic, on with Bill Cosby, when those women came forward who were raped in the 1960s, they didn't call it rape, and they didn't even know what it was that had happened to them. They did not even have a vocabulary. They just knew it was something bad and wrong, but the whole idea of a date rape or drug-facilitated sexual assault, it just wasn't even there. So even just the fact that victims now today have a vocabulary to talk about it and hear other people who look like them talking about it and share that experience, I think it's giving more courage to other victims to come forward.
Your book really does a great job giving us a sense of place. We can all, if you step foot on a college campus, kind of get the feeling of what you call Tower University. I'm wondering if you would read a passage for us. And this is at the very, very beginning of the book as Emily is leaving a bar. It's right at the, you know, early part of her freshman year. And she heads right into Dylan and his posse.
Thank you. A raucous bunch of Beta Psi boys rounded the corner. Dylan was in front, of course. He was the alpha dog in any pack of males. Tall and swaggering, dressed in clothes that were both effortlessly casual and painfully expensive, he could be a poster boy for fratty privilege. The other guys clustered around him, vying for position. Emily froze a few feet from the entrance to Lucky's. Its cone of light still surrounded her. Dylan's eyes locked on hers. He smiled, walked over, and stood in her space. Too close. The other boys formed a semicircle around her. She felt unsteady. "I don't want any trouble," she said. "Doesn't seem that way," Dylan drawled. "Seems like you're doing everything you can to stir the pot." "Whore," said one of Dylan's minions. The kid snorted, cocked his head, and spat. His phlegm arced through the air, reflecting the light from the bar's neon signs, glittering and ugly. Everyone watched the loogie as it hung suspended for a moment at the top of its arc. Then it headed back down and splatted on her boot. The boy's laughter was loud and vicious. Anger pulsed through her gut, more acidic than any shot at Lucky's. "You're disgusting," she told Dylan, "and you can't even fight your own fights." Dylan frowned at his friends, and they stilled. Their silence was more ominous than their laughter. Emily was keenly aware that she could not control this situation. "Head in," Dylan told the other guys. "I'll be right there." "You sure, dude?" "Yeah." The boys did what they were told. Music pulsed, then quieted as the bar's door swung open and shut. Emily tried to move away too, but Dylan's hand clamped onto her arm. They faced each other, a boy and a girl alone on an empty stretch of sidewalk, breathing fog into the night. "Have you thought about what you're doing?" he said. "Like, really thought about it? Because it's kind of crazy that this is how you want to play it." "I'm not playing." His finger squeezed her arm through the puffy coat. "You know what this means for you. You are done." "Oh, Dylan," she smiled. "I'm just beginning. I'm writing an editorial, too. It'll be in next week's Tower Times." He said slowly, "My family will end you. I know who your family is, and pretty soon they'll know who you are, too."
I'm speaking with Allison Leota, reading from her latest crime novel, The Last Good Girl, that deals with the issue of sex crimes on college campuses. The story is set at a fictional university in Michigan, and Allison draws her inspiration from cases that she handled as a federal prosecutor. Title IX and the Clery Act, how valuable are those laws for prosecutors? We hear about them. Are they worthwhile tools?
Oh, absolutely. They're worthwhile tools. They need to be enforced. And I think the problem is they haven't been that strongly enforced in the past decades.
Why?
In the past, when we think of Title IX, that's right, sports.
Athletics.
We think girls need a volleyball team. We think let's make sure there's a lacrosse team for the girls as well as the boys. And it has been used for that. But it's kind of sat idly to the side. Well, it's supposed to also prevent gender discrimination on campus. And gender discrimination, one of the strongest forms of gender discrimination, is sexual harassment. And I mean, if there's a systemic culture where girls are being sexually assaulted, what could be more harassing than that? Given the statistics that we're hearing, that even President Obama at the White House is telling us 1 in 5 girls are sexually assaulted while on campus. That is gender discrimination, and that's where Title IX comes into play.
What do you hope that your book will do if parents and students are reading it and deciding what college to go to? What kind of questions and research should they be asking and doing?
There's two kind of resources I see. One, are there just a ton of online resources. Just if you're thinking, maybe I want to go to U of M, Google U of M sexual assault, see what comes up. That's just very easy. There's the White House Task Force, the American Association of University Women. All of these have amazing tools for finding out what is going on at different college campuses. But in addition to that, it's just your basic kind of gumshoe detective work. And the best detectives have a notebook and some people skills. Go and talk to people in your community. If you're thinking of going to a college, ask that tour guide, you know, the woman who's showing you around. Does she know anyone who's been sexually assaulted? Does she know what to do if she's sexually assaulted? Is this talked about on campus? And I think insisting on having this conversation is one of the best things that you can do when you're looking into what is the culture at that particular campus.
The book is really, it's a cracking good read, and at the same time as you've gathered, you're going to pick up a lot of insights into what it is like, especially for parents that it's been decades since we've been on campuses, of what the culture can be like on the college campus today. Allison Liotta's crime novel, The Last Good Girl, being released today, and she's holding book signings around Michigan beginning tonight at Books a Million at 13 Mile and Southfield Road in Beverly Hills, and then on to Ann Arbor, Gaylord, and Novi through the week, and you can find details on her website. Allison, it was great talking with you. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. This is wonderful to be here.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President Obama's visit tomorrow brings the national spotlight right back on Flint and its water crisis. It has now been 4 months since Governor Snyder declared a state of emergency in the city. There were promises to fix the many problems Flint faces because of its water. Yet a bill that would send $144 million to Flint is still stuck in the state legislature. Has the state done all it can in the most timely manner to help Flint? Here with us is State Representative Sheldon Neely. He's a Democrat from the 34th District and a lifelong resident of Flint. Representative, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
House Speaker Cotter was on Stateside last Friday, and Lester Graham asked him if the state has done everything it can for Flint at this point. So let's take a listen to his answer.
I think we have done everything that we can at this point, but I say we're also working on future funding. So I think we've acted in a very timely manner.
Do you agree, Representative Neely?
Well, I think things could have been done a little quicker than not. But, you know, all the support that we're getting from House members, Senate members, Senator members, and executive staff and the governor's office, we appreciate. But the people and the residents inside the city of Flint think the delivery system has been somewhat anemic.
Meaning what? What is that feeling like to the people in Flint?
Well, right now, you have to understand that we're in the second extension of the emergency. First, the declaration of an emergency, then the extension of the emergency, and then the extension of the extension. And people right now currently are still drinking bottled water, bathing with bottled water, cooking with bottled water, with no real end in sight, with no real plan that has been prevailed to residents inside the city, telling them how they're going to move them to an interim stage of recovery to get them to that final stage. So we're still into the first stages. Residents are growing more frustrated as we approach the fourth month of the bottled water delivery system inside the city of Flint.
What could be done with that $144 million? I'm sure there's a lot of ways it could be purposed. Can you break those down for us?
There's a lot of schools of thought. What has to happen is a singular ideology of a focus. We have to think about the way that we're going to go about approaching this crisis, taking them from the intermediate stages of recovery to a permanent stage of recovery. I have my ideas how that recovery should look. The local elected officials, the municipality of the city of Flint has an idea, and the state also has a different idea. But we definitely need to all sit at the table, come up with a clear, concise, direct plan on how that recovery should look. Everybody deserves a high quality of life. And right now, the quality of life for residents inside the city of Flint is suffering. And we don't need to prolong that while we debate the issue on how these dollars should be used.
Have you sat at the table and talked?
I have talked at many tables at many different occasions. The clear and concise message has been something that's been missing from those dialogues. It's been more of a monologue from the governor's office on how the things should happen and how delivery should happen and how that recovery effort should look.
It has been a couple of months now, and I'm sure people are wondering, can't everybody in Lansing get it together for the people?
We need to really figure out which direction we're going and how to get there and how to expedite that effort. I'm willing to sit down with the speaker. I'm willing to sit down with the governor. I'm willing to sit down with the lieutenant governor. I'm willing to sit with whomever that says, let's go ahead and move forward. Let's get it together. The people deserve it.
What's the holdup in those sit-downs that you spelled out, Representative Neely? Why isn't it happening?
You know, we have to have people of like thinking. I think we have to really, really be on the same page about what we need to do and how we need to move this community forward, getting through the biggest health crisis that the state of Michigan has ever faced. We have to have people sitting down at the table in good spirits to whereby they are willing to engage in a dialogue and to come up with a solution from that point versus sitting at the table already with a predetermined direction in which you want to go. And in some of the instances that I've been at the table, I have felt that I'm facing a predetermined idea on how the process is going to go forth. And right now, we've seen many failed strategies. And some would say even that some are more concerned about a cover-up versus a cleanup. It should not be political. It should not be economic. It should be about quality of life and enhancing quality of life and restoring a good quality of life to residents.
Are you feeling it has been political?
It's been a recipe for disaster for the residents of the city of Flint. It's just a cocktail that's mixed in politics, economics, personal issues, emotion.
Can you take us a little further in what you mean? You're saying some people are focusing on a cover-up. Other people want to get things fixed. Who's doing what?
Well, I'm not making an indictment because that's not something that we want to do, and that's not the direction that we want to go in. We do know that the Attorney General's office is engaged in an investigation. We do know the local prosecutor of the Genesee County area where Flint is in Genesee County is engaged in an investigation. They have made criminal charges. We know that the federal government is engaged in some levels of investigation. So when I talk about a cover-up versus a cleanup, I think those that may be engaged in the criminal portion of it are very fearful of losing their freedom based upon a criminal charge that could be levied against them at some point in time, and they may be more concerned about their future versus the cleanup for the city of Flint.
Representative, the House voted last week to expand Medicaid for Flint residents, and Governor Snyder said a Senate committee is likely to okay that next week. Do you believe that will happen?
I'm prayerful that it will happen. As the people go through this crisis, it's much different to witness suffering than to try to live through the suffering, and this community is engaged in suffering right now, every day. And I just want to encourage those that decision makers to try to expedite this in the best possible fashion, absent of all those other impurities that could engage this process.
Representative, it sounds like you don't feel you have a lot of power and a big place at the table in these conversations and in decisions about your city.
We have our elements of influence, but we need everybody fighting for the recovery of this community because this is just not the Flint community. Today is Flint, but tomorrow it could be Bloomfield Hills or it could be Birmingham, it could be Grand Rapids. These things will occur if we don't find a good remedy. If we don't get the recipe corrected here, we won't be able to perfect it, antibody to fight this off anywhere else.
State Representative Sheldon Neely is a Democrat from the 34th District of Flint and a lifelong Flint resident. Representative, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. God bless.
94 of Detroit's public schools were closed today, nearly all the city schools. It's the second day of a mass teacher sick out over pay. Some 45,000 students missed class. In light of emergency manager Stephen Rhodes' declaration that the district will run out of money by June 30th without funds from the state, this seemed like a good day to talk with the state senator who's leading the push to get the rescue plan through the state legislature. State Senator Jeff Hansen is a Republican from the 34th District in West Michigan. Senator, welcome.
Thank you.
You have been driving back and forth to Detroit for most of this past year, talking with the many stakeholders in the Detroit Public Schools crisis. And I'm wondering, what is your view on this latest round of sick outs?
Well, it creates a challenge. Trying to make sure that we get enough votes to be able to pass something is one thing. This creates a challenge to try and get my colleagues in the House to support it. I actually just testified on a couple of bills over in the House that are in the package, and it was brought up, and the fact they are going to get paid, period, is, you know, was the statement that was made by the appropriations chair, in which I really believe that that was true.
There does seem, Senator, to be a divergence between GOP legislative leadership and the Detroit Federation of Teachers and the rank and file DPS teachers on how to handle this whole budget crisis. I spoke with Detroit teacher Sarah Jardine yesterday on the first day of what this union's calling the lockout. And here's what she said on Emergency Managers Road's statement about the reform package, the new co old co plan that would split the district into two entities needing to be passed if the teachers will be paid. Here's what she said.
And these Senate packages are actually, to the rank and file, very distasteful. And, you know, many of us do not think that this is what Detroit needs or that they want, actually. So we feel like we're caught between a rock and a hard place where, you know, he's saying we won't get paid unless they pass these bills. And yet these bills, to many of us, seem like a very bad idea for public school in Detroit.
And I guess this perspective gives us a sense of what you're trying to work with as you try to craft a solution. So how do you answer teachers like Sarah, Senator?
Well, I've spent a lot of time in Detroit. I've talked to a lot of different groups. I've talked to their union. I've talked to the pastors. I've talked to parents. I've talked to students. I've talked to the mayor and his administration. I worked with Students First, Excellent Schools Detroit, the coalition, you know, just trying to put things together with my Democratic colleagues here in the Senate, trying to put things together that fit. It was not an easy task to try and craft something that balances all of the different groups. And I guess at this time, I look at it as everybody might be just a little bit uncomfortable, both sides of the equation. So I think we're in a pretty decent place. Nobody's really, you know, nobody's getting hurt one way or the other. It's a solution to a lot of problems that we have. And this isn't, like I said, has not been the easiest task because of it's so emotional. You have so many people who I really have concerns about. Some people want to just blow everything up and let it all go. And it's like, we can't do that. We have 47,000 kids that need a great education, and we can't allow, you know, it to go down any more than what it is right now. We need to act now.
How do you explain when you've talked to, have you talked to teachers as well as union leaders?
I have. I have talked to several teachers, met with them.
And how do you explain their point of view to your colleagues in Lansing? And even more importantly, I'm interested in how are they responding to you when you bring that perspective?
Well, it depends on, I talked to my colleagues about what the bill does, you know, more so about what I see as a solution, a long-term solution, not, we have to stop having the short-term solutions like the $48 million we just passed, and then all of a sudden we got to come back in and look for something else. We need a long-term solution that actually gives them an opportunity to fix the problem. And I keep talking about this is, you know, I want to give Detroit the tools that they need to fix their problem because I don't want it to be a Lansing fix. We're not coming down to fix it. And I've told them all the way through is, you know, if you're expecting me to come and fix this, you've got the wrong guy. But if you want me to stand next to you and help you fix it, I'll be here all day.
Now, some of your colleagues in the legislature are referring to these sick outs using terms, for example, House Speaker Kevin Cotter calls these teachers egotistical and says these sick outs are, in his words, a selfish and misguided plea for attention. Governor Snyder said it's not a constructive act. And then, of course, as we know, unlike the Senate version of the reform package, the House package has some punitive measures that seem pretty aimed squarely at the teachers' union in a sense of saying, well, we're going to show them who's the boss around here. Does all of that help the district or does it throw gasoline on the fire?
I think it's unfortunate. I'm not trying to punish anybody, and that's why I took this on in the first place is because I don't have a need to punish people. I want to fix the problems. And by getting caught up in all of the minutiae and the noise going on, you lose track of what you're trying to do, and that's making sure the kids get the education that they deserve. So we have to keep our eye on the prize and let the other stuff kind of, you know, it just kind of go like, you know, water off a duck's back or something, because we have to make sure that at the end of the day that what we're doing solves the problem.
I think for some that this kind of the kind of statements that blame the teachers seems like a like an attempt to direct attention from the fact that this is largely the state's mess with DPS under state control since 2009. And as you've been doing all of this work over these last 9 months, what is your sense of your fellow lawmakers and how much responsibility they feel for where things are now?
Well, I think in the Senate, I thought it went pretty well. We had a really nice mix of Republicans, Democrats as it went through. But, you know, part of my message has been that we have to let the past go because we can't change anything. We have an opportunity from today forward to make changes that make the difference in Detroit, in the Detroit schools. And so we have to look from today forward. It's like pushing the reset button and getting things moving forward. And I know there's a lot of animosity about things that have happened in the past, one way or the other, a lot of finger pointing back and forth. But all of that does is what, you know, it's kind of like poisoning the water, you know, the well. It's like, I'm sorry, those things are important to a point, but when what we're trying to do, we can only affect what happens today forward.
And you referenced that what you were able to do in the Senate seems to be a positive and bipartisan approach. So are you kind of aiming your words at colleagues in the House as well as the teachers who are standing outside the Fisher Building in Detroit today?
Well, I think that it needs to be a bipartisan package because most of the legislators from the Detroit area are Democrat. And, it, you know, we do have Republican control, but we have to work together on this one. This should not be something that is political. It should not be divisive between the two. We need to work together and get this done.
And when you look at the House version, and it's got that much harsher edge than what the Senate version has, can this all be worked out? What is the next step to move this forward?
Well, I hope it can. The House is working on some things, and I hope they're able to look at everything and take, you know, step back and take a really long look at everything. I mean, we don't have a long time to do it, but I want to make sure that they understand how we got to where we were, where we are, from where we started, and it's been a long journey.
Senator, we had a statement, a press release from Ivy Bailey, who's the interim president of the Detroit Teachers Federation, and her words were, educators will be locked out of their schools until we hear three simple words, I guarantee it. What is your sense about how long all of this might go on, this latest job action?
Well, I'm not sure how long they're going to be doing that. It's, you know, today in the House Appropriations, they, you know, had several people that said, you know, everybody's going to get paid for every hour. So I'm not sure how long that goes on.
Now, you've just received an award from the NAACP, the Mary Church Terrell Freedom and Justice Award, and it's for the work you've been doing all of these months trying to get this DPS rescue plan through the Senate. We're interested, you know, why is a senator who represents this small, mostly white rural community in West Michigan, were you willing and interested in volunteering and taking on the challenge of Detroit Public Schools? Why was this important to you?
Well, we have a school in my district, Muskegon Heights Public Schools, that went through the same type of thing. They created a new district there, and then the old district in the same way just existed to pay off the debt. And so I had an understanding of what they were asking, number one. And I really feel that we have to make a difference. You know, the saying is, if not me, who? If not now, when? We don't have time to wait. We can't lose any more time with these kids. We need to make sure they get their education.
State Senator Jeff Hansen, thank you so much for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much.
And just this afternoon, the House Appropriations Committee adopted bills to fund and overhaul Detroit Public Schools. The House version has less money for DPS and would impose more limits on collective bargaining than the package already passed by the Senate. All the proposed legislation would most certainly move to a conference committee made of members of both bodies. They'll have to hash out some sort of compromise. We don't know yet how long that process will take. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair, Mike Blank, Tony Brown, Josh Hakala, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.